typefaces like superheroes all have origin stories. From Garamond to Georgia, Palantino to Proforma, the look of letters tracks back in time to a moment of inspiration that can be fascinating or frightening. Welcome to Beyond the Book, Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. My name is Christopher Keneally, and for our conversation today, we really will go beyond the book, diving down to the level of individual letters. Joining me from London is the author of Just My Type, out recently in the U.S. from Gotham Books. Simon Garfield, welcome to Beyond the Book.
Hi, Chris. It's really nice to be talking to you.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you join us today, and it's a book I'm really looking forward to talking with you about. Just My Type is subtitled A Book About Fonts, and while our listeners wrap their minds around that intriguing notion, let me also tell them about your work as a book author and journalist. Simon Garfield is the author of 12 books of nonfiction, ranging from The End of Innocence, A Study of AIDS in Britain, which won the Somerset Maugham Prize, to The Nation's Favorite, The True Adventures of Radio One, which can be described as a year in the life of a radio station. Simon has also written for The Independent and The Observer. And Simon, Just My Type arrived in U.S. bookstores at the end of August and has already seen a number of praiseworthy reviews in major newspapers, and we hear you're on the New York Times bestseller list, so congratulations on all of that. But most of the reviews begin along these lines. Who knew a book about typefaces could be so interesting and so much fun? Are you surprised at that reaction, not only that critics enjoy the book, but that they express such shock over the subject?
Well, it's interesting because when I told my own friends that I was doing a book about fonts, I had two reactions. One was, what? And are you mad? And do you really want to spend a couple of years on that? And the other was, great. I love fonts. I can't wait. And so it's a kind of absolutely more than anything else I've ever written. It absolutely sort of split people. I'm happy to say that the former group, the what group, are sort of coming round to it now, especially those who have read the book, and they think, actually, you know, this is interesting. You know, they do all the fonts from whatever it is, you know, Arial to Baskerville to Helvetica to Century. They do all have an interesting tale. These things don't fall from the ether. They are put together with a huge amount of thought by very skilled people. And so it's really, you know, I think as we say at the beginning of the book, it's about fonts, but it's really a book of stories behind the fonts.
Absolutely. And, you know, the invention of the printing press, of course, gave birth to the first typeface. But for the first 500 years or so of publishing, the only people who worked with type were in printing or in publishing. That's changed, and there's one individual who gets the credit for changing all that. Can you tell us that story?
That's right. I mean, a man who sort of in recent days, we've read a lot of kind of great things about when he retired from Apple. And so Steve Jobs, he dropped out of college 10 years before he made his first Mac, and he found that he had a lot of time on his hands, and one of the things that he enjoyed doing was dropping into courses that he had no obligation to go to, but he just found them interesting. And one of these was a calligraphy course, and Jobs kind of found that he, you know, that there was a fascinating tale about letters, about letter forms, about why they look the way they do. And then that made him think about fonts. And then, you know, the Mac came about, and we are the beneficiaries, or we were the beneficiaries in the 80s of, as you said, a kind of choice that we never had before. I mean, on the very first Macs, they were fonts that resembled ones that were previously available only to professional typesetters and graphic designers. And he called these after places that he'd been to that he liked, including Los Angeles and Venice. I think there's a London font as well.
There's a Chicago as well, I believe.
And a Chicago, exactly. we had the first effectively the first pull down menu. I don't actually think it was a pull down menu as such, but at least we had a choice. Whereas before, you know, even if we did have a computer early on, they tended to be this sort of dot matrix thing, which looked you know, it's sort of the font really depended on your printer as much as anything else. And it made us all into font gods, and sort of after that, Windows or PCs followed suit. Microsoft, I should say, followed suit pretty soon afterwards. And we now, you know, with any new computer that we have, we now have a choice of 50 or CXD fonts to choose from.
Well, how do you think the rise of the screen culture is affecting typography? Certain fonts simply don't render as well in pixels as they do on the page. And is that, are we losing anything as we transfer from page to pixels? And well, obviously the choice has grown, but is legibility or any of those old arguments coming back?
Well, you're quite right. There are a lot of fonts that don't work across the board on the internet, and there are increasingly now the arrival of things called web fonts, which are sort of guaranteed to work across any medium. I don't think we're losing them. I mean, I don't think, you know, the great typefaces, the Baskervilles and the Garamonds and the Caslons, aren't going to go anywhere. But you're right, especially on the mobile devices, this is a particular dilemma. So on the iPad and the Kindle and our mobile phones as well, the smartphones, we have a very, very limited range. In some cases one, and in some cases 8 or 9, but that will change as well. I mean, I'm convinced that, you know, lots of stories about the new Kindle coming up, I'm sure we'll have a much greater choice of fonts with which to read, and the iPad as well. So it's a gradual process. I mean, it's interesting you talk about, you know, 500 years ago. We're not sort of quite at the point where we're, you know, redefining the way type looks, but certainly in the last few years, when we can, you know, take anything anywhere and read anything anywhere, we have had new challenges.
Well, Simon, you devote an entire chapter to the argument about legibility and readability, some of which relates, of course, to this transition to the screen culture. Is there life left in that old debate? And can you tell us what it was that Beatrice Ward cared about so much back in the 1930s?
Well, I mean, Beatrice Ward was, well, first of all, she was one of the few women in type. At that time, she worked for Monotype in London and elsewhere, and she wrote a great deal as well about type. And her thinking was pretty kind of pure, I suppose. I mean, her not quite in these words, but she believed that, you know, we shouldn't really notice type. Her one of her most famous essays was subtitled The Crystal Goblet. The idea being that, you know, if we drink fine wine, we don't really want to think about the goblet too much, and so, you know, we should be able to read things clearly and easily, and enjoy the way that the words fall upon the page, but not be snagged by them, and certainly not have our eyes ruined by them. So her great thing was clarity, and the theory also was, you know, we read best what we read most. So, you know, we shouldn't frighten the horses with a lot of new types, and we should familiarize ourselves with the great types. But obviously, a lot has changed since the 1930s, and I'm happy to say that some of that theory sort of no longer holds. You know, we certainly don't want just the kind of 1930s monotype types that we had then, which were now, I think we'd regard them as very traditional and rather dull and unexciting and unoriginal. So, you know, we look at modern advertising now, and, you know, the idea of clarity certainly doesn't hold the way that it does, say, in books. So in books, we're still fairly traditional. We still tend to use a serif face in most cases. And, you know, Times New Roman looks fine still. You look at the billboards, if you had Times New Roman big on that, you'd soon get very bored. You probably wouldn't buy the product. You think, God, this is an ancient thing. You know, so I'm kind of, although I'm obviously fantastically respectful of the types of old and the types that still work now, you know, I'm absolutely delighted. Every month I get a huge amount of new types from all the kind of font bureaus and font shops on the internet. And there's some quite wild things in there that I'm sure Beatrice Ward would not approve of.
Well, you know, looking in the other direction from the wild to the, you know, not terribly exciting, I'm going to say a single word, and then I hope you'll tell us what it means to you. And that word is Helvetica.
Okay, well, I have to admit that the idea of the book came about pretty much when not long after the after Gary Hustwit's Helvetica film came out. And that was, I'm sure a lot of listeners would have heard of it, even if they haven't seen it. It's a fantastic documentary about why Helvetica is everywhere and why it took off and about its history and why it works even now. An editor thought, well, you know, okay, Helvetica, it is a great story, but there must be lots of other very good stories about all the other typefaces, which is how my book came about. Helvetica, I'm actually, I shouldn't talk about this in too much detail. I've just folded away a T-shirt which has Helvetica on it, and it's from the Strand bookstore in New York. And it's a T-shirt that I absolutely love to wear. Helvetica just looks great for me, even now. You know, there's lots of thoughts that, well, it's we should use something else. It's such an obvious choice. And it's used from, you know, American Apparel to BMW to Saab to, you know, sort of, you know, half the products you can mention. You walk through kind of any big city and you see it everywhere. But for me, it still works. Invented in the 1950s, and it hasn't kind of worn thin. I do talk in the book about a man who called Cyrus Highsmith, who set off with a grand mission to try and spend a day without Helvetica. And he proved this. He proved this was a very, very hard task. So he would get up in the morning and he had to sort of check his clothes for Helvetica washing instructions, and then he had to be careful about what he read in the newspaper, and he couldn't really get the, he lived in New York or just in one of the boroughs. He couldn't get into the city because obviously that meant seeing Helvetica on the New York subway. He obviously couldn't turn on his computer just in case anyone sent him a email in Helvetica. He found that, I mean, I'm going on, so I will stop at lunchtime. And at lunchtime, he found that he couldn't even go to his favorite Chinese restaurant because that had Helvetica on the menu. So on and on, but I'm one of the great Helvetica supporters.
Well, I recall discovering Helvetica as a font. I had never thought about it before until I worked in television, and it was the one that just rendered, as we thought at least, the best on the screen. So that was a good reason for it in that particular instance. I want to ask you about what we do when we choose a type for whatever we're working on, a sign or an invitation. How do we know when something is right and when it's not? Are we relying on stereotyping? No pun intended.
Yeah. There is a bit of that. I mean, we, you know, I'd say if you had to pin it down, that the sort of two great attributes that good type has is clarity and emotion. And, you know, really, I think, again, going back to the pull down menu, only when we have that. So we put a document, we put a, you know, a CV or a job application or, you know, any other Word document into a whole range of different typefaces. And we find pretty soon that they tell a different, you know, a different tale. So we can set one in, you know, Gill Sans, which is, you know, it's obviously a reasonably modern typeface if we're looking back over 600 years from, you know, the beginning of the last century. And it's a Sans typeface, so we think, well, it's going to be sort of quite more modern. And it looks very, very clear, and it looks authoritative, and it looks as if we know what we're talking about, and it has a certain boldness to it as well. But then obviously, we put the same document in Comic Sans, and it's a very different thing. It looks like something that maybe a kid would have composed for their, you know, for their school project. So those are kind of, you know, obviously those, let's say, are two extremes. But if we see a type that we like, often it's very hard to say why we like it. It's a bit like a song or painting. You can say, okay, well, it's got great composition and it's been put together very well and it sings to us, but there's something deeper as well about great type. I mean, as you said, it's a sort of inherent knowledge that it's just right, it feels right. It's a bit like when you put on a suit that fits. Obviously, a fantastically sort of subjective thing as well. And people tend to be very passionate and obsessive about their fonts, and heated arguments, you know, online about what works and what does not. And also, there's a kind of great feeling that people possess their own fonts and they have their own favorite fonts. And, you know, and woe betide you if you criticize it.
Well, to that point about passion, Simon Garfield, I understand there's a typeface that you find absolutely wretched yourself, but that everyone in London is going to be looking at everywhere they go come next year.
Yeah, that's the London Olympic font. You know, it's less than a year, and I see it everywhere I go in London, on the sides of buses and cabs and down the underground, and a huge amount of emails I get because I applied for tickets, and everywhere you go now. And so goodness knows what it's going to be like in a year, but pretty unbearable, I think.
And because?
Because it is, I think, probably the most unathletic, unsporting font you could ever imagine. It's a very ugly, in my opinion, jagged font, which looks as though it's been put together without any great care. I'm sure that isn't the case. I'm yet to get any explanation about response from anyone who thinks it's great. I'm slightly ashamed that this is the typeface that we're sort of presenting to the world. You know, I'm sure this isn't the best we can do. And then I thought, okay, well, listen, you know, when I first saw it, I don't know, a year or so ago, I thought, well, I'm going to get used to it. You know, and like a lot of things, you know, maybe tricky music, tricky 20th century music, you hear it a few times and you think, yeah, no, that, I can understand it now. But I've looked at the Olympic font many times, and I'm afraid to say it doesn't work for me even now.
Well, apparently the only thing about that font that's athletic is it makes you want to run in the other direction.
That's right, yeah. And I kind of said, well, listen, I just, you know, I hope for the athlete's sake that they don't put it on the medals.
Oh, right. Well, we have been enjoying our chat today with Simon Garfield. He is the author of the new book from Gotham Books here in the U.S. called Just My Type. He's joined us from London. Simon Garfield, thank you so much for being with us from Beyond the Book today.
Well, Chris, I really enjoyed it.
Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, like Beyond the Book on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at our website, copyright.com/Beyond the Book. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Chris Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.